May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Devere Whittle. In this credibility case, the prosecutor's expression of his opinion repeatedly during his closing argument, vouching for his three state witnesses, jeopardized the fairness and integrity of Mr. Whittle's trial. As the prosecutor pointed out in closing argument, the case was based primarily on the testimony of three witnesses who all had credibility issues. Basically, it can be characterized as a drug deal kind of gone bad, that the two women, Ms. Biddle and Ms. Stewart, were parked in a car, and the victim and another man came up and parked behind them. And the issue is whether or not the gentleman who was supposedly one of the sellers, my client, shot and killed the victim in the car that was parked behind Biddle and Stewart. Now, none of the witnesses that the state relied on as their central witnesses actually saw Mr. Whittle do any shooting. They heard gunfire, they turned, and they either saw him running or assumed that he was the shooter. And this is important because these are the three witnesses that he refers to during his closing. All three of these witnesses had prior offenses, and Ms. Biddle was able to identify Mr. Whittle later that night from an array that had pictures of two other individuals that she knew. Ms. Stewart was not able to identify him that night and was able over a week later to identify him from nine photos, five of which she knew. And Mr. Owens was high on heroin that night. As the state acknowledges in its brief, the prosecutor is not allowed to, or no one's, defense counsel either, to comment on the credibility of a witness, because the credibility is an issue solely for the jury. And if the state or the defense is allowed to endorse witnesses...
Let me make sure I understand your comment.
Yes.
When you say not allowed to comment on the credibility of a witness, certainly counsel is allowed to comment on credibility as it relates to the evidence that's consistent or inconsistent with the testimony, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that was poorly said.
Vouching means something more than that.
You're correct. It was not very artful there. With respect to, you know, prior offenses and certain evidence that shows, detracts, or helps support credibility, yes. Vouching is an endorsement by, and in this case, the prosecutor, where it leads the jury to believe that it is his personal opinion that that person is telling the truth or not. And I'll give you an example from here. From the very beginning of the prosecutor's closing through the end.
Yeah, I'm sorry to keep interrupting,
okay.
But just so it's clear in my mind that I haven't misread the transcript, the comments that you allege to be vouching in the sense that we've condemned in numerous opinions over the years, it occurred in the opening summation, but not in the rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's correct. Those are the ones I address. However, upon further review of the rebuttal, which is in the transcripts, there was a comment made by the other prosecutor that Ms. Stewart was telling the truth, and she had done so all along. And that is at July. It was on the July 24th. Transcript at page 116. However, that was not contained in the briefing. When the prosecutor in the opening summation started his closing, it was, "May it please the court, counsel, ladies and gentlemen, Mia Biddle was right." And he goes on and on and does it throughout the entire closing. It's his theme. And at the very end, he says, "And because Mia Biddle was right, and because Camelia Stewart was right, and because Namil Owens was right, folks, there's only one right verdict in this case, and that verdict is guilty."
And your view is that this constituted, that is, his repetitions of the word right, constituted the prosecutor impermissibly suggesting to the jury that, in the prosecutor's own opinion,
yes,
with all of the force of the state behind it,
right,
they should believe the state's witnesses.
Correct. He said this
as distinguished from merely commenting on what, you know, permissibly commenting on what the evidence shows.
Correct. He said this at least 20 times within an hour. And
can I interrupt?
Yeah.
And get to the difficult issue that we frequently see. Did anybody object?
No, Your Honor. Unfortunately, they did not. And what I would respond to with respect to that is that this court has in the past, unfortunately, dealt with situations where there's been an egregious statement of vouching and the defense attorney did not object. And this court said, when the comments are so bad and the failure of objecting is inexcusable, the court should step in. And when they don't, then we have plain error.
What do you make of the fact that the trial judge didn't interpose himself at any point during the summation, but at the end of the counsel's summation, he reiterated one particular charge that's relevant to that, which is, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, in effect, what counsel says is not evidence. And they're charged with determining the facts and assessing the credibility of witnesses. Is that of any significance?
I'd say it is with respect to actually supports our position rather than counterintuitively, and here's why. First, I would say that this reveals perhaps that the judge was aware that there were some improper things said. The other problem, though, with this is he doesn't specifically note what he's referring to. And if the jury were to disregard all this, they'd have to disregard the entire closing of the prosecutor, because the entire closing, the theme was Biddle's right, Stewart's right, Owens is right.
Well, let me stop you there. In terms of the witnesses, they're all right. Wasn't it Biddle's right, whatever is whoever's right, and the reason that person is right is because X, Y, and Z, and it all fits together. Why is that out of bounds?
Well, respectfully, that's not what happened. Each statement was either preceded or followed by an inference that the prosecutor wanted them to make. And in fact, in one case, it was incorrect. The prosecutor said Camilla Stewart was correct because the defendant was limping because he had an injury to his leg. Well, that particular witness never said he had an injury to his leg. She said he had a tattoo. So that's incorrect. Now, that's more of a minute point. But what's important here is he says that these people are correct because he did the shooting. Now, the state's own witnesses were internally inconsistent, and there were several inferences that could have been drawn from within each individual witness's testimony. And this is different. Like, if you have a case like in Shea or Daniels, in Shea, for example, there was a case where the prosecutor said, you know, five-year-olds don't make this stuff up. First of all, it was only one comment. Secondly, it was referring to an uncontradicted conduct that the mother had referred to that this child engaged in that a five-year-old wouldn't know about. And in Daniels versus State, there was actually no specific word used, but the court said, look, this prosecutor's okay because they are drawing an inference for the jury. They're making an argument from the evidence. If, for example, in this case, there had been physical evidence of the court took judicial notice that it was raining that day, and she testified it was raining. If the prosecutor said she was right, it would be further along in a proper comment. But the prosecutor is not allowed to characterize any evidence, whether it's correct or not.
So let me see if I have it right. You're claiming that the prosecutor was basically making bare or bald characterizations without any effort to tie the witness's testimony or to reconcile it with the objective facts, the objective evidence. Is that correct?
No, I wouldn't say he was making bald assertions. He referred to the evidence. But what I'm saying is when he said they were right, I'll try to give you a good example. Camilla Stewart was right. That was the defendant limping because of an injury to his leg who told the men in the black car to park, and then who started shooting at the black car as he ran across the sidewalk. First, she didn't testify that there was an injury. She said it was a tattoo. It had a bandage over it. Secondly, while she said that that man told the gentleman to park their car, their other witness, one said he didn't remember that happening. The other one said it did happen, but they didn't know who said it. So I guess what I'm saying is that's a legitimate inference that he wanted them to make. But that's not correct. She didn't say she's right, she did this. But even if that he is commenting on the evidence, this court in Brokenbrough versus State said that it adopted an analysis from United States versus Lefebvre in the Third Circuit. And in that case, the Third Circuit said, look, it is not proper for a prosecutor to characterize evidence that's even clearly in the record. And there were two other federal cases that I've cited, and I'm sure more, United States versus Roberts and United States versus Kerr, where the court said, look, it doesn't matter. Even if the evidence is in there, it's not his position to characterize it for the jury. And he even said to the jury, look, when you go back there to determine whether she's right.
So you're making two arguments, and one is that even if there were evidence from which that would support the characterization that witnesses X, Y, and Z were right, it was improper vouching.
That's correct.
But secondly, it was improper because there was no such evidence.
Correct.
And there was no attempt to refer the witness's testimony to the non-testimonial evidence. Is that your point?
That second point I haven't made clear, I guess. What I'm saying is, yes, he did refer properly to evidence in the record. That's not an issue. But when he said, Ms. Stewart is right, he gave an inference of what she was right about. And that was not, that's a possible inference that can be made out of many inferences that could have been made from the evidence. But then to say she's right, and the worst part of this is at the end when he said the only right verdict is guilty. In United States versus Young, the United States Supreme Court said to tell a jury that, for example, you need to do your job and come back with a guilty verdict is inappropriate.
Let me ask you a question I think will be reflected in the state's position, but they'll correct me if I'm wrong about it. I expect to hear that, well, just referring, whether it's 20 times or in 10 separate instances several times, that a witness the prosecutor called to the stand's testimony was right, that witness was correct or right, that in context, it's not a problem. It's just the use of a word that generates a problematic argument, but as a matter of fact, each time the reference was used in context, there were references to why it was consistent with other evidence that was in the record. What's your response to that?
Twofold. One is that's not always the case. There were times that he was referring, facts were incorrect, what he was saying that she was right about. And secondly, the term right is a synonym to truthful and includes the definition of conforming to rights or truth. And veracity includes that same definition. And the state did not, in its response brief, contest that right equals truth. And to say that 20 times and throughout an entire argument, and even if the judge gave an instruction to disregard it, they would have had to disregard the entire closing argument. In this case,
is it correct that what we're dealing with here is the contention that this is vouching and there are many cases that establish this to be vouching, and the state's taking the position that there's no vouching and no misconduct at all? The focus here isn't on prejudice. The focus is on whether there was prosecutorial misconduct, as we characterize that rather harsh term, or not.
Right. I think that the state's position, if I have it correctly, is there was no improper conduct, that using the word right is okay as long as it refers to evidence in the record. And again, as Justice Jacobs pointed out, my position is it doesn't matter, first of all, whether they refer to the evidence. It's a characterization. And secondly, I would argue that in this case, what they were saying they were right about were not things that were clear-cut. For example, Mia Biddle and Camilla Stewart, yeah, they did testify that they saw the shooting. But then they said later, we didn't see the shooting. I heard the gunshots turned and saw him running, so I assumed that he was the shooter. And then to say, as if that's an established fact, that they were right that he was the shooter, is what is improper.
Well, you know, basically, if I understand your position, you're saying that this continued repetition, well, the invocation of the word right and its continued repetition was not an appeal to the rationality of the jurors. It was an appeal to their emotions, particularly for their respect for the state and its lofty position. And that's what made it cross the line.
Yes.
The problem I have is that that was not apparent to anybody at the time. Nobody objected to it, and the court did not stop the argument. The court did give an instruction, but we don't know. The record doesn't show why.
Right.
So, you know, isn't there something more that's required for us to conclude that this was impermissible vouching rather than just taking liberties, perhaps, with a term?
Right. Well, I would argue that, unfortunately, there are situations where attorneys do not object despite the fact that what has happened is egregious, and that's what happened in Morris versus State, and the court reversed in that case. And the problem here is the court stated in United States versus Young, by characterizing this, that it carries with it the imprimatur of the government and may induce the jury to trust the government's judgment rather than its own view. That's the problem. That, well, he says it's right, it must be right.
Well, the problem I'm having is this. You're doing closing arguments. You want to pull together all the best evidence that you've put on. And you say something along the lines of, well, look at what you heard here. So-and-so said this, and so-and-so said that, and it all makes sense. They, you know, it's consistent, and it shows that this happened, and that happened, and the other thing. You know, one could characterize that as the prosecutor is telling the jury who's right and who's wrong. But that's part of closing argument.
Yeah, but in that particular case, for example, it's usually a measurement against something that is not in dispute. So if you have, for example, like in Daniels, you have DNA that showed that the person was there, and you can say the DNA, so-and-so's testimony is consistent with what the DNA showed, and you can make a conclusion that means that he was there. And in fact, on many occasions, that's what the argument is about, is saying to the jury, here's what you could conclude and here's why you should conclude it, not this is the conclusion because she's right.
Did you want to save your last few minutes?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Maria Knoll representing the state of Delaware. Appellant Whittle was not denied his right to a fair trial. The comments made by the prosecutor in closing statements did not constitute impermissible vouching and were specifically tied to the evidence. The prosecutor did no more than permissibly argue the state's case to the jury.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, Your Honor.
When you talk about being tied specifically to the evidence, let's put aside for a moment the use of the word right and what the ordinary dictionary meaning of that is and what that might imply to the jury. Just one example, and I quote from the prosecutor's summation, the initial summation. And so when Mia Biddle tells you the person was standing under a street light, it means she is right. It means that the gunman was behind her car. How is that not a comment on what evidence you should believe because the prosecutor believes it to be so? If the prosecutor had said, this comment by Mia Biddle is consistent with the other evidence in the case, and here is the other evidence consistent with that testimony. That's one thing. But he's saying, when she tells you the person was standing under a streetlight, she's right. And what that means is the gunman was behind her car. Now, what's a lay juror going to take from a comment by a prosecutor who presumably the jury understands has the file, has talked to the police, participated at least in part in an investigation? The danger is, what other information might that prosecutor have other than the evidence itself that allows him to make a statement that's unfettered, uncompromised, unequivocal about the credibility of a witness?
Your Honor, in this particular case, when the prosecutor indicated that Mia Biddle was right about the defendant being behind her car under the streetlight, that was immediately followed by evidence regarding the photograph that Detective Flaherty had showed to show that there was a light right behind where her car would have been to corroborate that.
We're talking about comments made in a summation. There was no comment following that about what you're explaining. Following that was, and so, she was absolutely right about that. But that's not the only evidence that tells you Mia Biddle's initial observation about where the defendant was standing when he started shooting are correct.
Well, while I understand Your Honor's what Your Honor is saying to me, what the state is arguing is that you cannot look at each sentence within a vacuum. This entire closing was replete of instances where the prosecutor also said, the evidence shows you this. He said that at least 15 times.
My problem, I think, is obvious, given the number of cases where we've spoken to vouching, particularly in a case which is admitted by the prosecutor in the summation here as one that is based almost entirely on the credibility of these witnesses. A prosecutor with all the authority of the state behind him, and with the implication he has information that others might not have, makes a flat comment that his witnesses that he called are right, meaning they're correct, meaning they're telling the truth. And credibility, their credibility, is the central issue in the case. It's as if no case we've, or any opinion we've ever issued in the past, cautioning about the dangers of vouching, was read by this prosecutor. Why use this terminology? Why not say what he's trying to say without the danger of vouching, that their credibility is an issue, and here are the facts that are consistent with their testimony? That's the way in which lawyers fairly search for the truth. They don't try to substitute their judgment for the jury about what's credible and what's truthful. And it's particularly dangerous when a prosecutor does so. That's what our cases have said for two decades.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I've reviewed the cases in the past two decades, and this court has held that in a number of instances there has been prosecutorial misconduct. However, with respect to the court's rulings in these cases, the court has also consistently said that when the comments made by the prosecutor can be tied to the evidence, which it was in this case over and over again, that that does not constitute improper vouching.
Okay, I thought we would hear the context argument, and I understand that you can't, as my paperwork shows, simply isolate the numerous times the word right and correct are used apart from the context of the entire summation. However, it doesn't explain why the word right, meaning correct, meaning truthful, is the word that's used, as opposed to the testimony is consistent with the weight of the evidence, or the testimony is credible because it's supported by other evidence in the case. That's the way in which all of our case law suggests attorneys, officers of the court, are to represent their adversarial side and at the same time do justice. Now, why is the word right used here and repeatedly in light of the cases cautioning against vouching?
Well, Your Honor, the word right was used here, and the state argues the word right was used permissibly because it was tied to the evidence in this case. And I understand what Your Honor is saying. However, my reading of the case law has never come out and said that you cannot say the word right or correct. In fact, that some of the case law has discussed the word lie.
Well,
some
could you say then, since it's a virtual synonym in the in context, Mia Biddle was telling the truth. Camelia Stewart was telling the truth. Namiel Owens was telling the truth. And so on. Mia Biddle was absolutely telling the truth about that, simply substituting truth for right.
There's a number of synonyms to substitute for right as well as correct, Your Honor. And what the prosecutor was not saying was Camelia Stewart has a reputation for truthfulness. Mia Biddle has a reputation for truthfulness. The prosecutor never went beyond that.
The danger is he's saying, I believe she's telling the truth.
He didn't say, I believe,
he
Your Honor.
He didn't use those words, but
correct.
That's a clear inference. When he says she said this and she was right, what does that convey, or what is the danger of what it might convey, which is even more important than how you interpret it with hindsight.
Your Honor, while I would agree with you, had the prosecutor said, I am saying she is right, would be a problem, that is not what happened here. The prosecutor indicated she was right because the evidence shows you she's right. That is completely different.
If he had said that, it might be completely different.
He did say that on a number of occasions. The evidence shows that. At the beginning, when the prosecutor indicated Mia Biddle was right and Camelia Stewart was right, the next sentence is, that's what the evidence tells you beyond a reasonable doubt. The evidence tells us a story, and he goes in and tells all the evidence that corroborates that.
And at this conclusion, he says, and because Mia Biddle was right, and because Camelia Stewart was right, and because Namiel Owens was right, folks, there's only one right verdict in this case, and that verdict is guilty.
That's correct, Your Honor. And before that, he had said, that's what the evidence tells us. And a number of times in his closing argument as well, he told the jury, as the judge told the jury, that the jury were the ones that were going to have to decide, and they were going to have to make determinations as to credibility.
What's your take on why Judge Seitz had to give an unusual additional instruction at the conclusion of the summations?
Your Honor, I scoured the record because I obviously didn't want to misstate anything. There is no indication as to why he gave that instruction again. I've had it given in other cases.
It's always included in the general instructions.
I had it reiterated before, but there is no indication he did not say why.
Can you tell me the case?
Out of the 100 or so I have tried? No. And then at the end, the judge indicated that he was very happy with how counsel tried the case and that it was a pleasure, and nothing came up that he had any problems.
Is it correct?
I can't answer why he said that.
Is it correct that this case is a credibility case?
It is the credibility of three witnesses with a little bit of physical evidence. So, yes, for the most part, it is a credibility case.
Doesn't that kind of color the way the court should view prosecutorial comments? If we're talking about a case where there's a wealth of evidence that's solid, if you will, that's physical evidence that really can't be disputed, and then in addition to that there are some witnesses, isn't that a very different situation than when we have witnesses as the evidence that's going to convict the person?
I would say if Your Honor found improper vouching in the first instance, that would be a consideration. However, the state is setting forth that this isn't improper vouching and it was specifically tied to the evidence.
No, what I'm trying to ask is whether the concept of improper vouching should be applied more rigorously in cases where the only evidence, or virtually the only evidence, is based upon the credibility of the witnesses.
I think it should be stringently applied, yes. When there's instances of improper vouching, then there are three considerations to be addressed, and that it does include the closeness of the case, and credibility would play into that. However, in this case, while it was a credibility case, followed by some evidence of ballistics as well as the trajectory inside the vehicle, it is three different witnesses, two of which did say at court that it was the defendant that was firing the weapon. The state is not of the opinion that it was that close of a case.
Well, just to particularize a little bit, Justice
yes,
Berger's question, there was no camera that filmed what happened, correct?
There was not.
There's no DNA evidence or fingerprint evidence that linked the shooter to the victim?
Correct, there was not.
Okay. And the prosecutor pointed that out to the jury in the summation, which leads one to infer that maybe why it was even more important to tell the jury that the witnesses that he called, whose credibility was an issue, were right.
Obviously, Your Honor has that impression. Again, the state reiterates that with respect to this court's case law.
I just said it was a fair inference. I didn't say I had that impression.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. The state submits that based upon the entirety of the state's closing, everything was tied together, and he basically said over and over again, the witnesses were right because the evidence shows you that they are right. Evidence is corroborating each other. The evidence shows you it's right.
Does Hunter come into play at all in the analysis?
Hunter, the repeated error, I believe, is the Hunter
yes.
case. I don't believe so, Your Honor, and the reason I don't believe so is because improper, you would have to find improper vouching.
No, I understand that. I should have been clear. I understand your theory. We never get there because there's no improper conduct. I completely understand that. But my question is, let's assume, Justice Hall isn't here to state a hypothetical, but let's assume hypothetically that we find that there's improper vouching, or at least in one person's analysis there might be. Do we address Hunter at all because of the cases that precede this about vouching?
Obviously, under Hunter, you would address the several times whether it was how often there were instances of improper vouching. That is an issue. The three issues, once you determine there are improper vouching, though officially, are the centrality of the issue, the closeness of the case, and the steps taken to mitigate. To the extent Hunter plays into that at all, those are the three answers that we have to.
Okay. But I am correct that you're not arguing harmless error here. You're arguing flat out, go for the goal, so to speak. There's no improper conduct.
Your Honor, the state, the case law supports that there was no improper vouching in this case.
Okay.
If the court has nothing further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just want to address the Chief Justice's question about the analysis to be used. Because this is unfortunately a plain error case, under Baker what needs to happen is once the court finds misconduct, then it must look to see if it's so clearly prejudicial that it is substantially or it violates substantial rights of Mr. Whittle. If so, the court reverses. If not, then the court looks to Hunter as to whether this cast doubt on the integrity of the judicial process, and the court may reverse at that time. And I would argue that in this case, we do have a close case. It is the comments went directly to two central issues, which was credibility and reasonable doubt. There was a frequency of the comments. There was limited mitigation in this case. I would argue that the instruction given was not effective at all. Given that, I would ask the court to either conclude that this was plain error, and if not, to reverse under Hunter.
Well, what I'm getting at with Hunter is, looking at this case in the box in which we find it, or looking at this case in the context of the cases about vouching that came before it, and put aside the contention over whether it really constitutes vouching or not,
okay.
Do we look at past cases? And should we be concerned about the integrity of the judicial process when we have a substantial number of vouching cases, if we decide this is indeed one, if we decide it is indeed one? Does Hunter come into play in the sense that while it might not have affected the outcome directly of this case, it gives us serious concern about the integrity of the system if our case law is being ignored?
Absolutely it does. It comes into play if the court finds that the improper comments did not constitute plain error as ordinarily defined under Wainwright. If the court finds it's plain error, then the court's done. If not, then the court does look at the integrity of the system and the other cases, and that's what this court said in Baker.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and recess.